This episode is presented by Shaxbury Cider.
This week on Meat and Three, we're getting semantic to understand the deeper meaning behind some of the foods we love. First, we'll look at the big debate happening around the word milk.
Who the hell are you to tell me what is the name of my product and my landscape and everything we've cared about when, you know, you don't have anything invested in except to put out a little money to buy it? It's our entire life.
Then we get the lowdown on the language of cider.
So the first thing that's really confusing about dryness is that it has nothing to do with how something actually feels in your mouth.
And finally, we get our fill of tiki talk.
You don't walk into a tiki bar and be like, oh yeah, this is what Polynesia is probably like. Like, it's supposed to be like fantasy and stuff. That's the hard part. It's so easy to do tiki bad, and that's where it gets a bad name.
Tune into this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen podcast, Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the good fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome culinary icon and frequent Julia Child collaborator, Chef Jacques Pepin. In this episode, we're going to talk to Jacques about his latest projects, another Emmy Award, and we'll get a treasure trove of Jacques' best Julia moments. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. From the start of her career, Julia was all about collaboration. Despite her rather singular fame, she rarely did any of it alone. While it's fair to say she really made mastering the art of French cooking happen, it was birthed out of a collaboration with her friend Simone Beck and Louisette Bertold. On TV, the French chef was all Julia on camera, but she was supported by a much larger team at WGBH, including producers Russ Marash and Ruth Lockwood. Not to mention her husband, Paul Child, who really helped Julia hone her on-air persona. Someone else Julia collaborated with to great success was her dear friend, Chef Jacques Pepin. Behind the scenes, Jacques and Julia's relationship was rooted in their mutual love of cooking and desire to advance the stature of cooking teachers, particularly reaching out to home cooks. Together in 2001, Julia and Jacques won a Daytime Emmy Award for Outstanding Hosts of their 22-part PBS series, Julia and Jacques Cooking at Home, which followed on from their beloved Julia and Jacques Cooking in Concert specials. Outside of his collaboration with Julia, Jacques Pepin has had a storied career in food. Born and raised in France, Jacques became a professional chef there, even at one point working as a private chef to Charles de Gaulle, before immigrating to the United States. Once in America, he was the executive chef for Howard Johnson's before writing his groundbreaking book, La Technique, which helped steer his career towards becoming a television star slash, as I'm sure he'd prefer to say, television teacher. He's made hundreds of hours of television produced with KQED-TV, the most recent of which was Jacques Pepin, Heart and Soul in 2015, and has authored, by my count, more than 25 books on cooking. Like Julia, he received one of France's highest honors, the Légion d'honneur, in 2004, as well as some 24 James Beard Foundation awards. He currently serves as Dean of Special Programs at the International Culinary Center, formerly known as the French Culinary Institute, in New York City. It is always an honor and a privilege to talk to Jacques Pepin. Welcome to the podcast, Jacques.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. So before we talk about you and Julia, let's just talk about you. And you recently started a new foundation and wanted to hear much more about that and particularly why you decided to focus on culinary training.
Well, actually, you know, it's my son-in-law and my daughter. My son-in-law, Rolly, is a chef for 25 years. He teaches at Johnson & Weill. And he started that foundation for me. We discussed it, and I thought it was a great idea because I have so many video of technique, and I have 30 book. And using those video and technique and book, we wanted to teach, you know, disenfranchised people, like people coming out of jail, homeless people, drug addict, veteran, you know, people like that who usually are in a community kitchen. But the community kitchen, whether it's in Hartford here or in New York or in Boston or in Seattle, they don't really have any program. They don't do the same thing. So in establishing a program with the technique so that if people can learn those basic things, then they can be employed and join back the workforce. In addition, they supply, you know, those community kitchens with enough money to buy whatever they need from, you know, from different pants and equipment and you know, clothes for the cook and so forth. So that's what we do.
And how, I know you kind of only recently launched, what, last year? And where are you sort of in the phase of rolling out the training?
Well, we started a couple of years ago, but we've done very well. Last week, we have the big meet of the Jacques Pepin Foundation on Thursday at the Yale Club in New York, and we raised $500,000, you know, so that was quite good. And we have all of the chefs, you know, from Jose Andres to Andrew Zimmer, Carla Hall, Tom Colicchio, and many others were there. So it was really very moving for me, you know. So,
well, I think it's really lovely. The foundation is you, as you just said, started with your son-in-law and your daughter, Claudine. And so it's kind of all in the family. And Then you had this wider family of all the people you've worked with over the years. You've been helping out to help get the foundation, to help grow the foundation.
Yes, and I think it can help people, you know. So, I mean, Julia knew that too. When we did, she has different scholarship as I do. And when you see someone that you know could never afford either Boston University or the French Culinary Institute in New York, where I teach, and you see them 10 years later as being executive chef in an hotel, so you know you've changed the life of someone, and that feels good.
Absolutely, yes. Nothing is more gratifying than giving scholarships to have someone who dreams about a career in food or in the kitchen and then see how they've progressed and what's happened down the line now.
Absolutely.
And what, so you've kind of touched on this a little bit, but I think in the kind of the present, but in the future, like what's your hope and aspiration that, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, what the foundation will be able to achieve?
Again, the foundation will work with, there is over 100 different community kitchen, or more than that, in the country, and we work with a bunch of them, but especially establishing a curriculum for the cook, which any cook who come and is able to do. We haven't finished the curriculum completely, but from peeling an asparagus to poaching an egg to boning out a chicken, so they will have to go through that kind of accreditation, you know, that I have in my technique and so forth. And with that, they'll be able to rejoin the workplace. So that's a good thing to do. And I'm not talking about young people, 22. I'm not talking about people to work at, I don't know, Daniel or Perse in New York. I'm thinking about people 30, 40, 50 years old, just to rejoin the, you know, the cooking world and have a, you know, a small eating place somewhere.
Yeah, no, I think one of the things that we've noticed at the Juilliard Child Foundation is there are a lot of these kind of programs or a lot of people wanting to start these programs. Do you really see the foundation becoming more of a sort of resource and clearinghouse than actually the service provider?
I think so, yeah. That's what my son-in-law wants to do. In fact, you know, last week, we were very proud of it. He got his PhD last week, and he did a doctorate in education. And basically, his doctoral dissertation deal with that type of problem and what we are doing at the foundation.
Yeah, no, I think from our foundation side, we really see the vast need for that, and that unfortunately, a lot of people, because America is such a big country and disconnected, they're kind of always trying to reinvent the wheel. Yeah. And you know, our great hope for your foundation is that you can really help people avoid doing that by saying, look, if you want to do it, great. Here's a curriculum, and hopefully here's some funding, or here's how to get funding to further it. Do you feel like...
Yes, because you see that curriculum is not based on the French cooking, for example. And it's based on technique more. And that's why I have book, you know, my book on technique and other that I've done. I did that in 1974 and it's still in print. Because the way you sharpen a knife or beat an egg white or peel an asparagus or bone out a chicken is the same, whether you cook Italian, Spanish, Greek or whatever. So that's what we want to teach, those basic technique.
Well, I think it's wonderful and we wish you great success, and we'll look forward to, we'll have to have Raleigh and Claudine on to, in 10, 20 years to give us an update on what's been achieved.
Good, good. I won't be around.
Well, you never know. Oh, yeah. You're still going strong.
Yeah.
So on May 3rd in 2019, in Julia's hometown of Pasadena, no less, you are going to receive the Emmy Award for Lifetime Achievement at the 46th Annual Daytime Creative Arts Emmys, the first time such an award has been given to someone in the culinary programming category.
Right.
So what does it mean to you to be the first person recognized by the Television Academy in this context?
I'm kind of, astounded as well as delighted. I know that... I am in line. Many people could have received that before me, certainly. Julia and Craig Claiborne and even Anthony Bourdain or James Beard. So, but this is now that the food world is coming in a way that it has never been before. I mean, considering that Jose Andres has been nominated for a Nobel Prize. So, it's just amazing what's going on. And I think... I'm sure that Julia would be delighted with that. And I am, of course, delighted. I mean, a bit anxious in a sense, but I don't really know. I've never been that much in that world. And so I don't really know exactly. I know what it means, but not completely, maybe.
Well, I think after your long career, it's nice to have still be going to an event that's surprising or where you feel like there's a learning curve.
Yeah, certainly. Yes, because, I'm in another world. So.
Well, yes, but I don't know how many hundreds of maybe thousands of hours of television you've done. That's why you're getting the award. So you're certainly part of that world in that context.
Yes, to a certain extent. That's true. But I mean, as Julia used to say too, we're not actors. We are who we are. I mean, I'm not Dr. Kilder, 1 week and someone else next year. I am who I am and I do things the way I do. So it was for Julia. So, but it's certainly fantastic to have that type of recognition.
So it was curious. I was there when in 2015 you became the first recipient of the Foundation's own Julia Child Award, and I was curious how you might compare the two events and experience. Obviously, one's already happened and one's to come, but how do you think they will compare?
Well, there is similarity, of course, when you we received some touch of an accolade, but with Julia, I think it was something much more personal for me because I was friends with her for close to half a century, and it was really a type of food world that we knew, and so for me, the recognition with Julia was very meaningful this way on a personal level. So it's different than that.
Yes, there might be more of a cast of thousands at the Creative Arts Emmys.
Yeah.
And does anything stand out in your mind from that night, receiving the Julia Child Award and getting your copper pan?
Oh, yeah. Of course, a lot of it thing in my mind, from Sarah Moulton to all of the people who were there, that was, and many of my friends. So, as I said, it was very personal that way. So, it was a great evening, so.
Yeah, no, it was. It was magical. So we've talked a bit about collaboration already, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about that, given your experience, because I feel like, while you, like Julia, have a certain kind of singular fame, mm-hmm. it's also come from collaborating and working with a lot of people, whether it's going all the way back to a restaurant kitchen before you were very well known, or with your books or on your TV show. So I was hoping you might have the secret to share with everybody about what is the secret to developing longstanding collaborative relationships?
Well, certainly you have to have respect for one another, and you have to keep an open mind. But actually, on television, I felt comfortable with Julia. I do with my daughter Claudine, with my dear friend Jean-Claude, but not that many other people, to tell you the truth. Very often, I know when I was doing theory at KQED that Tina, the producer, said, let's bring some other chef. And we did sometime. But, you know, when you have another chef coming to cook here from, I don't know, Alice Water to any other people, you don't want to interrupt them. You don't want to, you know, put yourself in front of them. You want to give them. So it's not that easy. And unless you are, as I was, very friend with Julia, so I could interrupt her as well as she interrupted me, and discuss and have disagreement and so forth. So you cannot really do that with everybody. Even with a friend like Roland Passot, with a great chef in San Francisco, two-star restaurant, he's from my hometown in France, he came on the show. But, you know, he's doing something, so I don't want to interrupt it. And it's his own thing. It's not something that basically we are doing together. So it was different. But then, in a professional kitchen, of course, it's another thing. There is much more discipline, and there is less talking. You know, the chef said, do this, that, to ordering, to pick up. You don't have to worry about the entertainment part, if you want, or discussing that with the public. So, but certainly in a professional kitchen, the teamwork is very, very important. Yeah.
And do you think that that discipline of having learned that you don't really have a successful professional kitchen unless you are working together? Do you think that, because I know what you're saying about being on camera with Julia, and that, you know, working with people you already have a good rapport makes it work better. But obviously you have to get to the place of having relationships that you could even do that. And Do you think that's just innate in your personality or something you learned in your years of experience?
Well, I guess yes, both. I mean, to a certain extent, when you're in a professional kitchen, you know, the teamwork is extremely, extremely important. I've seen it is not, I mean, the chefs now are much more likely to sign their dish and to make sure they know that I'm the one who did that too, which before, in all my training, and I know the training of Julia in Paris too in the late 40s and 50s, it was conformity. You know, you conform to the kitchen. You do whatever is done there. When I work at the Plaza Athénée in Paris, we did the lobster souffle, which was quite well known there. We were 48 chefs in the kitchen. I'm sure the 48 chefs could have done it, and you would never have known which had done it. So the idea was more conformity. Now the chef wants to sign his own creation much more than it used to be. So it's a different way of working.
Although, right, in today's world, the chefs who have multiple restaurants and, you know, at a high standard in particular, though, they are... Do you not think that they're bringing up chefs who can do the lobster souffle, if you will? You can't run multiple restaurants unless you have delegated people who can do your signature food.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the first one doing that, from Wolfgang Puck, certainly to Jean-Georges, you know, or Daniel, those are really, really very good at delegating, at training people, opening a restaurant. And I don't know whether I would have been good at that. I mean, I've never had several restaurants at the same time, so I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't, you know, I've been very good at that.
Well, you're certainly, you know, well known for being an excellent teacher, and I would have thought you can't get people to do your especially complex or sophisticated or complexly presented food unless you're a good teacher. Wouldn't you have thought that is an essential?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the teaching is essential, and that's what I kind of object to some of the television show that I see now, where there is so much yelling and screaming and competition, that this is not really teaching. But of course, this is television, so it has nothing. If the television goes to a place like Daniel and starts shooting, it's like a ballet, you know, with the chef ordering, pick up table 4-2, there is no noise, two, it goes. And after 5 minutes, the television says, that thing is really boring, you know, we're out of it. They want to go to a place where people are screaming, I'm not doing that crap, this, that. But in a kitchen, you don't run a kitchen this way. It doesn't work, you know.
Yeah, well, I like that analogy that the highest performing, most successful kitchens are quiet, and it and if you had a soundtrack, it would become like a ballet.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, right. Yeah.
That's a lovely analogy. I can picture. I think you're talking about Danielle and Daniel Boulud in New York.
Yes, you know? Yes.
Yes, I can see Danielle as the conductor in his immaculate kitchen.
Absolutely. You're the conductor when you're in the kitchen. And by the same token, the people who do the recipe is like the people of the orchestra. You know, you give the same recipe to five different people, you have five different dishes. So the interpretation is very important. So this is under the control of the chef d'orchestre. Remember in France, we call chef, when we talk about a chef in the kitchen, we say chef de cuisine. Because in France, we have chef d'orchestre, which is the conductor. We have chef de gare, which is the station master, you know. We have chef is used as chief of something. So, yes, the chef in the kitchen, chef de cuisine, you know, is like a chef d'orchestre, you know, a conductor.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of think that when you watch it on television or film, it often looks like these very experienced sort of figurehead chefs, and all they're doing is reading tickets, right?
Uh-huh.
But I think unless you've worked on the line to know how vital having a conductor is to actually get even not high-end food, but get hot food out in time, it's critical, right? And you have to have a lot of experience
not,
to be able to do that.
Not only getting it just on time, but getting it so that it tastes exactly the same each time. And that requires quite a lot of practice, and that's where the chef become very important. Because if you were to look at someone cooking in the kitchen and take note on one order, a chicken with mustard sauce, whatever, and write exactly what the chef do, then 15 minutes later, he has another order for the same dish. And it may do it 6-7 times during the evening. Well, 6-7 times it tastes exactly the same. If you take your note to know exactly what he did, he will never have done it exactly the same. So it's a question of a more intuitive. You taste, you adjust. You taste, you adjust. So you put a little bit of a tablespoon of water, it's too thick. You know, a dash of consomme, something, a dash of salt. Eventually it comes out the same way each time. And that's difficult. And that has to be the taste of the chef, the interpretation of that recipe is the way the chef wants it, you know, so.
Well, I think that's the amazing thing about cooking, right, is it's this very sophisticated combination of art and science. And the science, right, is the chemistry that if you've accidentally added too much water, then the last, you know, chicken with mustard you've cooked, then you have to adjust in a different way to compensate to end up with that same flavor, right? But you have to both know the science, back to your techniques behind it, but also have the artistry to improvise to adjust, no?
It's true, but I mean, you know, you have people, especially now, where a lot of book has been written about the chemistry of cooking. And you have some chemists who can tell you exactly why your sauce is going to break down at that temperature. So they can tell you exactly what goes on in the kitchen. They know all of the answer of this. And you go to eat at their house and you have a lousy meal. And then you go to eat at the corner of the street in Italy or in Spain or in France or the little woman who has absolutely no idea, never measure anything, and you may be the greatest meal of your life. So, you know, both of them are different things that you have to bring together.
Very true. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to devote the entire rest of the show to walking down memory lane with Jacques about his time with Julia. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Shaxbury Cider, who believe cider can be daring, complex, and eminently drinkable. Located in Vergennes, Vermont, Shaxbury make a broad offering of ciders, from the bright and fruity rosé to inventive small-batch wild apple fermentation. Each fall, Shaxbury takes to the hills of Vermont to forage for the wild and forgotten fruit that make up their Lost Apple Project. Shaxbury, producer of the first American-made Pet Nat cider, continues to experiment every year with limited edition ciders designed to spotlight locally foraged fruit. To learn more, visit shaxbury.com or follow them on Instagram at shaxbury.
Welcome back. We're talking to culinary icon, Chef Jacques Pepin. It would be impossible to have Jacques on this program without spending more than just one moment talking about his time with Julia. He's already mentioned a bunch. So we thought rather than limit him to one singular Julia moment, which could just morph into a bunch, we're going to lean into the opportunity and let Jock take us back to that magical time when it was also Julia and Jock. So let's start at the beginning. When did you first meet Julia?
Well, you know, I came in New York in at the end of 1959, and the food world was very, very small. I mean, considering that 6 months later, I knew what I call the Trinity of cooking in America, which is Julia Child, Craig Claiborne, and James Beard. And it was in the spring of 1960, I had befriended a lady by the name of Helen McCauley. She was the food editor of McCall, House Beautiful. She lived next to me in New York, so she kind of became my surrogate mother. And that's how I met James Beard and so forth, and even Craig. So she called me and she said, oh, I have a manuscript of a book there. Someone sent me. You want to take a look at it? So I came and looked at the Ruth manuscript, which was, of course, the manuscript of Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And I said, well, that's quite good. And she said, well, the lady is coming next week to New York. She's from the West Coast. You want to cook for her? I said, absolutely. So she said, well, you know, she's a very tall woman and she has a terrible voice. But so anyway, that's how I met Julia. And I remember that we spoke more French than English. French at the time was certainly better than my English was at the time. So we became friends at that point. And it's interesting because Julia always said that we started cooking together. And well, we did in some ways. I mean, Julia went to Paris 1949, and I entered apprenticeship in 1949. Of course, she was 23 years or 22 years older than I was. But the point is that the style of cooking, the way things were done at the time, we kind of agree on that. So that's probably maybe one of the reasons that we work well together and we had a good time, even though we argue all the time.
Yeah. So how would you describe what Julia was like off camera and away from maybe a public audience?
Well, that's the point, that she was exactly the same. I mean, whether she was on television, off camera, and so forth, which is not the case with many other people that have been on television, which get crazy when they're on the air, and as soon as the television is off, they're someone else. But not with Julia. She was the same. And in that sense, because she had a great... I don't know, she was very comfortable with herself, confidence in herself. And I have... You know, I've been many, many times with her where people would say, what is, I don't know, a new red peppercorn or something, you know, which is just a new thing that no one has heard of. She would never have any problem saying, I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. She would ask me, do you know what that is? I say, well, maybe I did, maybe I didn't. But then, so in that sense, she was very natural. And this is one of the reasons... When we did our show, that we didn't have any recipe. We had no recipe, so the cameramen, of course, were crazy because they didn't know whether we were going right or left or forward. But on the other side, it was very natural because it is like cooking with a friend or with a spouse or with a kid in the kitchen, and you follow your own impulse. The food is there. Well, we knew what we were going to do. I mean, more or less. We say, okay, let's do stew tomorrow, or let's do whatever.
Yeah, no, it was, so you're saying the cookbooks for Julia and Jacques Cooking at Home was reverse engineered. So you mentioned this briefly, and I definitely wanted to ask you about this. Your on-camera, quote, friendly disagreements with Julia were kind of legendary. So, but did Julia ever really piss you off, and where you had to sort of really speak to her about it? Or, I mean, I'm assuming off camera, or it was always kind of...
No. I think that the disagreement we had were really... superfluous, you know, they were not important. Like she like, I like, you know, kosher salt, for example. She doesn't. She like regular salt. You know, I like black peppercorn. She like white pepper. You know, so but those are not very important. We had disagreement It's interesting because we received many letters that she was much more French than I was. And it was true in many ways. So we had disagreement sometime on the old way of doing certain classic French recipe that I didn't do this way anymore. For example, when we did spinach, we had once. So the spinach in France, we used to drop the spinach into a pot of boiling water, bring it to a strong boil, cook it 1 or 2 minutes, drain it, cool it under cold water, and press it into a bowl of cooked spinach. And then if someone ordered spinach, then you take a bowl of that, you melt some butter, you add it, you saute it, and so forth. Well, of course, we did spinach there. I said, no, I took a handful of spinach, put it directly into a skillet with some olive oil, a bit of butter, a dash of salt, pepper, I cover it, the steam. No, she didn't want to do it that. So she kept testing my spinach, and she said, it's tough. No, that spinach is tough this way. It's not as good. It's bitter. It's not as good. So I keep testing it and said, no, it's very tender. I think it's fine. You know, so anyway, we had those type of funny disagreement. And also, I have to say, when we started the show, prior, she said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, I don't know. What do you want to do? She said, why don't you do a list of what you want to do, and I'll do a list of what I want to do. And she did a list of like, I don't know, 50, 80 dish, and I did the same thing. And I believe that three or four of my dish made it, and the rest was hers. So that was funny. But it was fine for me. Certainly other professional chefs, looking at it from another point of view, I like to cook without recipe much better than cooking with recipe. So as long as we had ingredients on the table, I was going to cook them one way or the other, you know. So that was fun. And it helps you to kind of create a type of cuisine which is more personal, a type of cuisine d'opportunité, you know, in the sense that why did you put scallion in there? Well, I had a bunch of scallion on the table, so I thought it was a good idea, so I then put them in, which if you follow a recipe, you don't do that, you know.
Well, I think one of you kind of described, I think, something fundamental about Julia's appeal was she really was sort of a stand-in for people who were really interested in learning to cook but a little bit fearful and really wanted elaborate roadmaps versus someone who's maybe a more intuitive cook like you're describing yourself. Do you think that's true?
It's probably true, yes. It's probably true because we were trained in different ways, you know. And for me, the training was, more automatic in a sense. I mean, cooking. And for her, she went on work. I mean, went to the Cordon Bleu, went and started cooking a great deal, but went and work on those recipes probably more than I work on recipe. You know, doing it, perfectioning the recipe, doing it again, and so forth. So, but one doesn't. The first time my wife went to Julia's house, it was in 78, I believe, 76, whatever. When I did after I did La Technique, it was 76, yes. And we came in the back of her house. You know, we never came through the front. The only time I went through the front of her house, it's when Paul wanted to show me the stained window that he made, which were part of the front door. But otherwise, we came through the back, and we ended up in the kitchen, and there was an oil cloth on the table with the crumb from the from the lunch, whatever, and she just sweep it up, and she said, okay, what do you want to cook? So each time I went to her house, you know, she said, what do you want to cook? I said, what do you have? And then we start getting stuff out of the refrigerator and we start cooking. During that time, my wife and Paul made cocktail and talk about things, you know. So we were, in that sense, comfortable with one another. And of course, certainly Julia was the anti-snub, you know. So she had no problem with having food. You know, I mean, she loved, of course, to have great, great food from a garden, too. But, I mean, she wasn't the one who said that there is no way you can cook unless you have the greatest, the purest, the most organic ingredient, which, of course, is better. But not everyone can afford it, you know. And she realized that perfectly well.
So she wasn't demanding a lobster souffle each time you entered her kitchen?
Oh, no.
So you, I wanted to talk to you more about that because I think it's such a special thing. You have a kind of trifecta experience with her kitchen. As you were just describing, you've been there socially as Julia's friend, and but you've also performed, teaching on camera for a show in the kitchen. And are they similar experiences, or actually did it transform into a set? What is that iconic kitchen really sort of mean for you?
The point is, you have to realize that we did not rehearse. So when we started any of the show, we did not rehearse at all. So we didn't really know exactly what would come out of that. And she liked to surprise me all the time, you know, like when we started a souffle and she came out with a gun to start the competition of me beating egg white by hand and her beating egg white with the machine, you know. So she would do that all the time. Or the time, I don't know, she dressed... it was the salad. What did we do? We did the salad. One of the salads that she actually created, or recreated, that she had when she was a young woman. She told me in Mexico, in the Caesar salad. So she came as dressed as Caesar to Caesar salad,
which of course has a lot to do with a salad from Mexico.
Yeah, right.
So are you saying that when she would do her crazy costumes or stunts or props, that she usually did them without you knowing in advance that she would do
absolutely.
Them?
Oh, absolutely. I never knew what she was going to do, that's for sure. And she always, you know, she was happy to work for PBS, as I am. Hundreds of times she said that, you know, we don't have to cow, to sponsor, we don't have to endorse anything and so forth. And it's true. And she was happy to do that as I am. But, for example, when two sponsors of the series, one of them was the Jess Jackson, you know, the Kendall Jackson company.
Mm-hmm, the
and the other one was Lando Lake. So I knew Jess Jackson personally. He sponsored already one of my show before, and his wife, Barbara Banky. And they were very, very generous people. And they had a company called, in addition to Kendall Jackson, Artisan and Estate, called La Crema, Stone Street. It's like 40 wineries. And in addition to that, they just told me, you know, you can use French wine, Italian wine, whatever you want. It's fine with me. So they were very, very generous this way. So one time they call and they say, can we come and look at one of the show? We fly in and we want to take you out and Julia and you out for dinner. I said, terrific. So they came. So the producer, you know, Jeff told me, all right, what are you going to drink? What are you going to? I said, Jeff, I mean, we always start the show by having a glass of white wine or whatever. It's not that we don't drink. So I don't know what we're going to drink. But so we had wine throughout the show. I forget what we cooked, but I knew we had some type of meat at the end. So at the end of the show, I tell Julie, okay, what do you want with that? You want a Merlot or maybe a Cabernet or whatever? She said, I want beer. I said, what do you mean you want beer? We don't have beer. She said, we have beer. She had beer underneath. So it was all planned for her. So she came out with the beer, which we drank on stage. So that was, you know, I say, you know, we don't have to cow to the sponsor, but we don't have to antagonize them, you know.
Yeah, Jeff Drummond has talked to me before and publicly to lots of people about that Julia really had this mischievous streak.
Oh, yeah,
and
of course.
Do you take that moment that it was being mischievous, or do you think it was she was really trying to show her independence, or just a combination of both?
Yeah, I would say a combination of both, without any question there. Because she did the same thing with the butter. And, you know, I would put half a stick of butter in a dish, and Julia came out and put another half stick. I said, Julia, too much. No, it's better. You have to put butter. So, fine. So we have the people of Lando Lake who came. I forget what the president or whatever. So Jeff, again, said, what are you going to cook? I said, well, I'm starting with an apple tart, so I'm going to do the dough. Julia is going to help me. And then it was maybe 15 minutes before we start that show. And all of a sudden, Julia said, I want to do my own dough. So I say, great, that's fantastic. Great, okay. So we start the show. I did my dough. I roll it. She helped me slice the apple too. We put sugar, whatever. We put it into the oven. And I say, okay, well, Julia is going to show you another dough now. And of course, she turned around. She said, well, Jacques is going to do it. I said, oh, okay. She already did that. And she said, I want you to do it in the food processor. I said, well, that's a good idea. Could show people how to do it this way. So I said, what, 2 cups of flour? She said, yes. I said, a dash of salt, dash of pepper, dash of salt, dash of sugar. I said, how much butter you want in there? She said, I want Crisco. I said, what do you mean you want Crisco? We don't have Crisco. Up, she had a can of Crisco underneath. So we grabbed the Crisco and we put half Crisco and half butter, and we did another dough, and I forget what we did with it. But again, probably as you said, it was a way for her to show, you know, to be mischievous, but also to show that she was not, you know, catering to anyone. So, yeah.
Yes, no, I mean, most people who said that they did, even not on television, but just in front of an audience, performances with Julia, she just really kept you on your game because she was just legendary for either doing what you just described or just deciding you know, the group had planned on doing crayfish for the morning. And she was like, no, let's do trout 5 minutes before.
Oh, yeah, she already did that. I mean, sometimes she wanted to change. I said, Julia, we can't. You told me beef yesterday. I have 2 fillets I bought. You want a loin of pork? We don't have it. So anyway, but it's true. When we were doing a tour together, one time we were in Sotheby in New York. And so we were a big crowd and we were going to have dinner with all kind of important people on top at the end, which we did. And then I have a friend of mine, you know, Molly Seffer from 60 Minutes, lives in here. He lived next to me in Connecticut. So I knew him for years and years. So I don't know, I think, I don't know, the producer, whatever, do you think that Molly would be the moderator for both of you? So I said, well, I'm sure I'm going to ask him. So I asked, and Molly was a tough guy, but he was kind of impressed by Julia. He said, you know, I've never met Julia. I said, well, you know, you're going to. He said, well, why don't we have a drink first in the green room and we discuss. I said, yeah, okay, let's all go have a drink in the green room first, but there is nothing to discuss. I told Molly, because we have no plan. There is never any plan for that, and you never know what she's going to say. Whatever. So, I mean, it's useless. He said, okay. So we started the show, and Molly introduced Julia, and he introduced me. And then right away, he opened for questions. The first question woman asked, she talks about, she said, oh, my uncle used to do a leg of lamb, this, that, too, something. And of course, Julia turned around and she said, this is a real stupid question. I mean, directly she tells the guy or the woman, it was a woman. So I turned toward Molly. I said, see, I told you, there is absolutely no way you're going to organize anything. You know, it comes out the way it comes out. That's it. You know, that's the way it was with Julia.
And why do you think there was a method to the madness, or was it just, you know, the fame gave her license to do what she wants? Or was there really kind of, even if it was a subconscious strategy to it?
No, I think that she was exactly the same way off camera or on camera. If she said something was stupid, that didn't make any sense, she would say so. As well as she said, no, I don't know what that piece of meat is or that ingredient is. She had absolutely no problem about admitting. I felt, you know, that she was a person who was very, you know, very, very confident with herself and with what she was doing and all that. And she didn't take it too seriously, you know, in other way. That's why she could joke about it. And but at the same time, she took it seriously in the sense that I have never been to a restaurant with Julia, and I've been to many restaurants with Julia, that she wouldn't go to the kitchen to say hello to the people and shake the hand of the dishwasher and everyone else. That always, you know. On the other hand, one time I remember we went to eat at Le Cirque, or Circo in New York. So I called, that's when we were discussing the show. So I called Sirio Mascioni, and I said, we're coming for lunch. He said, okay. So we sit, the two of us, somewhere else. And she really didn't realize that people at the next table were looking at us. Two people in the kitchen, there was a kitchen with a window. They were looking to see what Julia was doing. And we order different type of thing. But one of them, I remember, we had little string beans. And I knew when the string beans came, I knew just looking at them that they were not cooked enough for her. Mm. And I'm like that. I don't like it when it's just blanched. I want it to be cooked. But she continued talking. She took the string beans, chewed some of it with her hand, took what she had in her mouth and threw it on the floor under the table and kept talking to me and kept doing that. And the people next door were looking at us. The kitchen were looking at us. She didn't realize. We kept talking about what we were doing. But I've seen her that doing that several times too. She had no problem with that.
Yes, very down to earth. And
absolutely, yes.
In a certain way. So on that note, I really wanted to ask you, do you think, you know, just knowing Julia so personally like that, and from, you know, like you said, going back a really long way in all kinds of situations, when you think of Julia, do you think of her as a fellow culinary icon?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, she did influence already many more people than I did, and she was... absolutely. I saw her changing the shape or the way television was done. Because still now, I mean, I was with, a woman a while ago who said she was a culinary historian, and she said that there are 405 cookery shows on television. Well, I don't know if there is 405. That's sounds a lot to me, but even if there is 300. But I mean, the show which are done now have often not much to do with cooking. However, on PBS, and it's Julia who started on PBS, we still teach cooking. I think whether it's Lydia Bastianich or Ming Tsai, you know, or me, we do want, because even when what I learned from Julia certainly was... she told me at the beginning several times, you're too serious, you know, this is television, this is entertainment, you know, it's too serious. Yeah, we are cooking, but... And she was right. So I did. On the other hand, she wanted to entertain people, but at the end of each of the show, when we talked, she said, okay, what did they learn today? I mean, there was still the teaching element, which was very important for her, and still is, to a certain extent on PBS, and thanks to her.
Well, there you go. One icon describing another. Thank you for that. So do you have a favorite Jacques or Julia and Jacques moment? Share yours with us via email or even a voice memo to contact at juliachildfoundation.org. After the break, Jacques is going to share a final Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Michael Harlan Turkel, and I'm the host of The Food Scene here on HRN. This show explores the intersection of food, art, and design by talking to people who are inspired by these ideas. The show features food photographers, food stylists, interior designers, and so much more. All the players that make the world so visually delicious. You can find The Food Scene wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we asked our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she's inspired them in their career. We've already talked a lot about this with Jacques, but do you have an official one for posterity to do your Julia Moment?
Well, I would say that Julia, I think of her, especially when she came to my house to eat, and the way she was with the guests around the table and so forth, she was so down to earth and happy. I also always think of her in terms of my daughter, Claudine, because I knew Julia before my daughter was born, and she's 51 now. So when Claudine turned to be in her, after high school, she went to Boston University. So when I went to BU, often we met good with my daughter, and I took her to Julia and so forth. So she became fond of Julia and became very good at imitating her voice, to the point that we would be eating and Claudine would call and my wife pick up the telephone and Claudine would say, "Oh, it's Julia." She would imitate. And my wife would say, "Claudine, please, we're eating." The call, and she's out. And one time the telephone rang and Gloria picked it up again. And she said, "Claudine, stop doing that. We don't have time." And all of a sudden she said, "Oh, no, no, I'm sorry, Julia. No, I'm sorry. I'll call him. I'll call him. He's right there." So we end up, you know, confusing Claudine with Julia. So that was something always that we did funny in the kitchen. And very often when Claudine came to eat at the house, I still ask her, "Do your Julia impersonation."
That's so lovely and funny. And I'm sure Julia was very amused by that. Well, thank you so much for joining us. It is always, as I said, an honor and privilege to get to talk to Jacques Pepin. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Todd. Thank you for having me. And I'll have a glass of wine for Julia now. So
we all should. Excellent idea. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Remember to follow us on social media. Our handles are at Julia Child on Facebook, at Julia Child Foundation, all one word, on Instagram, and at Julia Child JCF on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at T. Shulkin, T-S-C-H-U-L-K-I-N. To keep up on the latest from Jacques, he's at Jacques_Pepin on Twitter and at Chef Jacques Pepin on Facebook. And Pepin is P-E-P-I-N. To learn more about the Jacques Pepin Foundation, go to jp.foundation, and they are at Jacques Pepin Foundation, all spelled out, on Facebook and Instagram. Jacques' most recent cookbook is A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shorey, published by frequent collaborator Rux Martin, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Recipes and highlights from Jacques' most recent television series, Jacques Pepin Heart and Soul, can be found on kqed.org/jpepinheart. And that's a wrap for Season 4 of Inside Julia's Kitchen. We'll be back in May with more brand new episodes. During the break, we encourage you to catch up on any that you may have missed. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at WGBH. Thanks, as always, to my co-producer of the Foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Matt Patterson. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novia Valtorni. Please give us a review. Do that if you haven't yet. It really helps new listeners discover the show. We are on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after, wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next season on Inside Julia's Kitchen.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, or connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage, and thanks for listening.